Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, August 29th, the last day of the first week of the semester, at least for this class. Okay, so what do we got to do today? We've got to make sure that everybody's logging into Blackboard. So if you've tried and can't get in for some reason, then you got to see me. I'll even stick around this afternoon so we can do that. Right, that's really important, especially for the one person that got an ad code on Tuesday. Okay, so it's important that you get into Blackboard. If there's a problem, we got to straighten that out. I can help you remotely, probably can figure it out remotely, but if you're here and I'm here, that's maybe even easier to do that. Okay, those of you that have lab today at 1:30 or at 5 o'clock, if I'm not there right at the beginning of the hour, call my secretary and have them remind me that I should be there. Okay. Not that I'm going to teach those classes, but I'm going to help with enrollment and give people ad codes if there is room. Okay, and I know on Tuesday I forgot. I got there a little bit late, but not too late. And let's see what else. If you want to add this class, you have to go to the beginning second of that lab, whether it's 1:30 today or 5 o'clock today, and I take roll call. I drop no shows and I add students right away from the wait list and then maybe even off the wait list. If there's more students that need to get in there. So make sure you're there right as we open lab. And the lab is, I can't remember what room it is, three something.
Three.
Morning. 336?
Three.
No, it's not. 316. It's right by the elevator as you go up, just to the right-hand side. So make sure that you all are there. All right, let's take a look at the schedule. Maybe this is how I'm always going to start, just so I can keep track of how things are going. So we first started with chapter one. We're going to move on to chapter two today after we mentioned a couple things in chapter one. And we got three lectures on chapter two. That's chemistry. A lot of people don't have a background in chemistry, or maybe it goes way, way back to when you studied chemistry. So this is important. This is kind of like the fundamental information that you have to know for physiology. And there's going to be some like organic chemistry, there's going to be some physical chemistry, but this just describes how things work inside our body. So our bodies can't disobey any of the laws of physics or physical chemistry or biochemistry or organic chemistry. So we're going to take a look at those. And your first exam, as you see, is on September 24th. That's a Tuesday, and that's about 3 weeks away. That's a really long period of time away, so you think you might be able to take this weekend off because it's a nice long weekend. But you know what? Now is a good time to catch up to everything and get ahead of schedule a little bit and really apply yourself, get ready for that test that really is going to be here before you know it, even though it's a couple weeks away. All right, so please prepare for those exams. And you have exam study guides and all kinds of stuff in Blackboard to work with. So I don't think you should be lost or bored studying that material, okay, because you can go over it over and over it again. All right, so since we talked about some things last time, like homeostasis, does anybody have any questions over what we talked about last time? Okay. Maybe you haven't looked at the material in depth yet to have any good questions, but maybe you have, I'm not sure. Just remember, homeostasis is a term that describes how our internal environment is maintained within a range that's suitable to support life. It doesn't mean that all these parameters like blood pressure and glucose concentration and water concentration, what else, body temperature is absolutely constant. It means all of these things are dancing around each other so that none of these parameters have to change by very much. Right? If they change by a lot, if your temperature changes by a lot, either too high or too low, that's going to be fatal. Right, so other things in your body have to compensate, and I just remembered a football player that died over the weekend, I think, high school football player, but it was not hyperthermia. That's usually the case this time of year. It was due to head trauma, so I can't use that as a good example. But it does happen pretty frequently that professional athletes, yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I'll check when the class is available.
Sounds good. Oh, okay. Really good. Thanks for stopping by, though. Okay. Okay, good. Thanks. Usually it is due to hyperthermia when somebody runs low on water, if they don't consume enough water, when it's really hot outside and they're probably doing double workouts every day. when they lose so much water, then their body can't compensate to cool them down, and their body starts to get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and they die of hyperthermia. So people our age usually are not so susceptible, especially trained athletes, like professional athletes that has happened to, college athletes that has happened to, and high school athletes that has happened to. All right, so I just remind you to remind the people in your family that are of the age that where they're very susceptible to that, namely your grandma, grandpa, and infants, that you really have to watch, make sure that they don't overheat when it's really hot outside. Okay. Okay, so let's move back to some PowerPoints. Chapter 1 right here. Okay, so I have one projector today, and we'll just squeeze everything that we want to talk about onto that one projector. We'll turn that light off. That light, what about that one? Okay, how's that? Pretty good? You can still sort of see your notes. So we got pretty far into this chapter. There's something that's really important, and of course it's an extra credit drawing for you in lab this week, is how do you draw out this concept map for a response loop? And the reason why I'm having you draw it out in lab this week, not only just to get some extra credit points, right, but because everything that we study in this class, you should interpret pretty much according to this diagram right here. Everything we're going to look at should be filtered by the information that we have right here. So we're going to be looking at how your body maintains homeostasis, and it does it through what, a response loop, and we're going to just look at all of these things in detail for a number of different things. Okay, but first we're going to start with something small, namely chemistry. So we ended up, I think, right about here. Remember, there's two kinds of feedback, and if we look at this response loop, a response loop always starts with a stimulus, ends with a response, and if the response subtracts from the stimulus, that's what we call negative feedback. And if it's negative feedback, it means then that that parameter is going to be driven back down to the set point, or back up to the set point, or back to some normal value, right? So negative feedback is really the good kind of feedback that maintains homeostasis. And if the response adds to the stimulus, then that parameter is going to be driven farther and farther and farther away from set point into a disease state, and indeed, in many cases, it's a fatal state, like hyperthermia that we just talked about. Okay, so make sure you understand the two kinds of feedback. Usually negative feedback is normally what is maintaining homeostasis, but there are a couple circumstances where positive feedback is used successfully, okay, to promote certain kinds of things in our body, and here's just a list of these things, and I'll point these out throughout the whole class because they're kind of noteworthy, because I can count the number of feedback mechanisms that are normal in our body on one hand, right? So that's why it's sort of interesting to see that. All right, so let's take a look at this response loop right here and correlate it with blood pressure. And you can tell me what kind of feedback is working right here, or if indeed any kind of feedback is. So here we have a person that's lying down, and when they stand up, their blood pressure in their feet goes up, blood pressure in their head goes way down, and you actually might lose consciousness. We call that orthostatic hypotension, when you can't maintain blood pressure when you change body position. So you have pressure receptors in your neck that are very important. So when you stand up, your blood pressure falls according to that measurement of those pressure receptors that are in your neck. So that is going to be the stimulus, a decrease in blood pressure. Right. So that is monitored. So what's the response loop? That's the stimulus. What's the next step in a response loop? Yeah, sensors or receptors. And the sensors are what we call baroreceptors in the carotid sinus. That's right at the junction of the internal and external carotid arteries. For sure, look that up in your anatomy textbook, okay, if you don't know exactly where that is, if you don't have a picture in your mind, because that's probably the most imaged area anywhere on a human body, because it's loaded with disease. Those blood vessels like to get diseased, and those receptors start to malfunction, and that area can actually throw a bunch of blood clots. And if it throws a blood clot into the blood, where does most of that blood go? If it's in the carotid artery, especially internal carotid artery, can only go one place. It goes right to the brain, causes a stroke, right? So that's a very important area, usually done with ultrasound. So these receptors, baroreceptors in the carotid sinus, then send information to the brain. And how do they get to the brain? Via an afferent pathway. Okay, and if you know the name of that nerve, that'd be really good. In lab, we actually talk about the name of that nerve. And it goes to an integration center in the brain, like the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. And the cardioregulatory center takes that information, compares it to something, which is what? The normal value of what your blood pressure should be. And what do we call that? We give it a special name. Yeah, the set point. And if the set point is equal to the blood pressure, there's no error. And the cardioregulatory center doesn't have to do anything. But in this case, there is an error, right? Because blood pressure is dropping below the set point. Okay, so the integration center compares it to set point. But what else does this integration center do? Okay, it analyzes, right? It knows there's an error, and it also then makes a decision on what to do. Okay, not to make, to further decrease your blood pressure, but to get it back up to normal because it is dropping. And then it sends that decision out from the central nervous system via what? Efferent pathway. All right, and it goes to a number of places, but at least on this slide right here, it's going to the heart, which is the effector organ, and it's going to increase heart rate. All right, so the speed of the heart is going to increase. Something else is going to happen too. When we get to the cardiovascular system, we'll look at this loop in a little bit more detail. But the force of contraction is going to increase. There's some effects on blood vessels as well. And all of these effects, okay, from all these different effectors, is going to increase blood pressure. All right, so that's the response, increase in blood pressure. How does that relate to the stimulus? Add or subtract from it? Yeah, it subtracts from it, right? Because the initial stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure, the response is an increase, they subtract from each other, all right? And so what kind of feedback mechanism is that?
Negative.
Yeah, it's a nice negative feedback mechanism which maintains what in your body? Homeostasis, that's right. So in this example, was blood pressure absolutely constant? No, it dropped and then went back up, okay? If homeostasis is maintained, right, then negative feedback is used. So if there's a drop in something, the response brings it back up. Right? It also means that if there is an increase in some parameter, homeostasis and negative feedback means that there is a drop in that parameter back down to set point. So on one of these previous slides, like this one right here, all right, things are going up and going down, and it only varies around the set point and never goes beyond the normal range, right? So these conditions right here are suitable to support life. Okay. We also talked about last time glucose regulation of blood, and here we have a couple of concept maps on how that happens, just generally speaking. And in lab, you learn that there are a couple different ways that you can think of control systems. Okay, and a good example of that, where we talk about it a lot in anatomy, is in the musculoskeletal system. Okay, for instance, the control of your fingertip that I have right here is under antagonistic control. And you might think, well, antagonism, I don't like to be around antagonistic people, so I have kind of a bad connotation to that, again, that antagonism word. Okay, but let's understand what that really means in terms of control systems. All right, so I have my fingertip, and last Friday I was pulled over by the people with the fancy blue uniform, hat and badge and sidearm, and they said, step outside your car and take your index finger with your eyes closed and put it right on the tip of your nose like that. And fortunately I could do that because I wasn't intoxicated, and I can sort of do it right now because I'm not intoxicated right now either. All right, so how did I have such nice, precise control and balance of my fingertip to put it right on the tip of my nose like that? What are some muscles that were working, and how were they working together? Well, there's the biceps brachii, which causes flexion at the elbow or flexion of the forearm, and it was working with the triceps that does what? It extends. All right, so those muscles are actually acting in opposition to each other. They're antagonistic to each other, but because of that, I had precise control of my fingertip, my hand, so that it could like reach my nose without poking my eye or poking the officer in the eye or anything like that. Okay, so antagonistic control is very important. You need to have a couple mechanisms, all right, that work against each other. And for instance, if you're going to draw some water out of a sink and you want it at a particular temperature, can you just have cold water faucet? No, because it just comes out cold. Can you have just a hot water faucet? No, because it just comes out hot. But what if you want something in between? Well, you got to have it hot and cold, mix it together, and then you can get to whatever temperature you want. And so think of hot and cold as being antagonistic to each other. And you're actually very familiar with these things because in an automobile, there are antagonistic systems that help you control that automobile that you use all the time. Does anybody think of two mechanisms that are opposite each other, antagonistic, but you would never dream of driving your car or motorcycle or anything else without those two things? The brake and the accelerator. That's right. They work in opposition, but because they're both there, you have precise control and balance over that vehicle. Right? You would never think of driving your vehicle without a brake. If you only had an accelerator, after work you could get in your car, hit the accelerator, drive home, maybe just fine, but once you got home, what would have to happen? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. All right, so that would not be very good. All right, so let's take a look at the control of blood glucose in your body, and it is under antagonistic control. That means there is something that raises blood glucose and there is another mechanism that decreases blood glucose, and when these things get mixed together, what do you have? Precise control and balance over blood glucose concentration. Most of you have heard of a hormone called insulin. Okay, that's pretty important. We don't really talk about glucagon very much, but that is the hormone that is antagonistic to insulin. So let's take a look at this map right here. Okay, and it's so blood glucose concentration is maintained by negative feedback mechanism. So when we look at this slide, how many sets of boxes do you see right here? How many sets? I see two. Okay, there's a set over here on the left, there's a set over here on the right. And because we can break down our activities, loosely speaking, into two kinds of states. You could be in a what we call a fed state, F-E-D, when you're eating. It's not labeled fed, but probably that would be a good thing to write right here. A fed state, when you're in a fed state, that just means that you have nutrition in your gastrointestinal tract that's being digested and absorbed, and it is placing glucose into your blood because there's glucose in your digestive tract. So it's going from your digestive tract into your blood. And when that happens, what happens to blood glucose levels in your blood? Okay, they increase, right? When you're in a fed state, blood glucose increases, especially if you're drinking a milkshake or something like that. Well, there are receptors in the pancreas, right? The islets of Langerhans have certain kinds of cells that can monitor blood glucose, and they notice there's an increase in blood glucose, and they're going to secrete a hormone called insulin into the blood. And insulin is a passport that many cells, almost all cells in your body, need in order to absorb glucose from the blood. Without insulin, glucose cannot enter most cells, and those cells basically start to starve to death when that happens. That's why this condition is so bad. But if insulin is present in some people that have this particular disease, then glucose can enter cells, and we say cellular uptake of glucose occurs. So if glucose moves from the blood into cells, what happens to blood glucose then? It goes down, right, because it's a zero sum. So the response, because cells take up glucose, blood glucose decreases. And how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? Does it add or subtract? It subtracts. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism helping to maintain blood glucose concentrations, right, at least in this one state. And that's really nice, but we said how important antagonistic systems are. So let's think of a second state, and this is in a fasted state, fed versus fasted. Let's talk about a fasted state right now. So if you're in a fasted state, what about glucose in your digestive tract? Is it there? Nope, because you haven't eaten anything. There's no glucose in your digestive tract, so you're not absorbing glucose from your digestive tract. So what happens to blood glucose under those conditions? It starts to decrease. Okay, and again, the pancreas, the islets of Langerhans, have glucose detectors, right? There is the receptor right there. It notices a decrease in blood glucose, and so it's going to compare that to the set point, make a decision on what to do, and this is what it decides to do, right? It's going to decrease the secretion of insulin, because what does insulin do? It decreases blood glucose, and that's the stimulus right here. Okay, so it decreases the secretion of insulin and starts the increase of another hormone called glucagon. And remember, a hormone is just secreted into the circulatory system. It goes everywhere, and it affects a number of cells. Okay, it decreases cellular uptake of glucose, which does what? It has a tendency to maintain blood glucose concentration if cells can't take it up. All right, but it also goes to the liver and it tells the liver to secrete glucose into the blood. Because our liver has a compound called glycogen, and the basic building block of glycogen is glucose. So when glucagon goes to the liver, it tells the liver to start breaking down glycogen into its building blocks, which is glucose, and the liver then releases that into the blood. Okay, when the liver releases glucose into the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It increases, right? And so the response is increase in blood glucose. What was the stimulus? A decrease in blood glucose, and how do they relate to each other? Do they add or subtract? Those responses subtract from each other, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so in terms of blood glucose, realize how important it is. There are two hormones that regulate that, probably a couple others, which we won't talk too much about. Okay, but these are very important. The one that we're really familiar with in terms of insulin, which produces, what kind of disease process does that produce when insulin is not working or secreted properly? What do we call that? Diabetes mellitus, right? Okay. All right, so here is a good basic flow diagram of how to understand diabetes mellitus, at least to some degree. And I said that most cells, almost all cells in your body, need insulin to take up glucose, and glucose is one important precursor molecule that mitochondria need to make ATP. And ATP is that energy molecule in our body. So if glucose can't get in, right, these cells can't make ATP very efficiently under most circumstances, and those cells basically starve to death when that happens, even though there's plenty of glucose right across the cell membrane in blood vessels. It just that glucose gets trapped in blood vessels and it can't go anywhere without that insulin signal. There are a couple of exceptions to that that we're going to talk about when we get into the endocrine chapter that are really important to know, for instance, if you have diabetes mellitus. Okay, so that's it for chapter one. Unless somebody has a question about chapter one, What about, in terms of homeostasis, is a parameter like blood pressure constant over time?
No.
No. It's going up, it's going down, but it changes only a little bit, right? It only changes within a narrow range that's suitable to support life. There's only one circumstance when your body temperature won't change, when your blood pressure won't change, when your insulin levels won't change, when glucose levels won't change. And what state is that? We talked about fed, we talked about fasting, but if all these parameters are absolutely constant in your body, what state is that? Then you're dead. That's right. Then you're dead, right? Okay, so remember, when you're alive and these things are being maintained by homeostasis, these things are just dancing around each other all the time. But when they go flatline, flatline is bad, right? That's death. Okay. All right, so one good place to start when we're thinking about something complicated is let's look at some small things. And I really don't think of anything smaller in our bodies than chemicals. So we're going to start with chemistry to understand how our body functions. All right, so this is why I recommend people take chemistry or refresh their memory about chemistry before taking this class. But it's not a prerequisite according to our professional programs right here. But many colleges, it is a prerequisite. Okay, so in this chapter, we're going to look at how atoms are put together. We're going to look at some subatomic particles, but not get too carried away, because we want to understand something about chemical bonds. We're going to look at maybe four important kinds of chemical bonds by strength, all right? And then we're going to look at some things that change the reactivity of chemicals with each other, and that is how basic or acidic the environment is that these chemicals are in. So the acidity or alkalinity of a solution radically changes the reactivity of metabolites in our body, right? So it's really important to know how acidic our bodies are, and a measure of that is pH. So we're going to become familiar with the pH scale, and then we're going to take a look at some important biological molecules, and I see four classes of important biological molecules. All right, they're labeled organic molecules right here, but we're going to talk about the difference between a biological molecule and organic. There are many organic molecules that have no place in our body or in biology anywhere, but nonetheless, they're organic molecules. So these I would like for you to see as being important biological molecules. All right, so let's start with an atom. That's the smallest unit of a chemical element that we're going to look at. And an atom has basically two regions, but in those two regions, it can have three different kinds of particles. So the model that we're going to use to understand an atom here is what we call the solar system model. And that means that in the very center of an atom is going to be the nucleus. But that's different than the nucleus inside of a cell. Okay? And that's also different than a nucleus inside the brain. So we're going to, unfortunately, we use that term a lot, nucleus, to mean a whole bunch of other different kinds of things. Right, so nucleus in the cell contains genetic material. What about the nucleus in the brain? What is that? Anybody remember from anatomy? It was like a long time ago when you looked at that, at least over summer break, you forgot that. All right, a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies inside the central nervous system someplace, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and these things are not myelinated, and so that area looks gray. All right, so a nucleus in the central nervous system is this gray area that's loaded with nerve cell bodies, and they're all communicating with each other, so that's an important center, as opposed to a tract, which is a group of axons going someplace in the central nervous system. So central nervous system you can break down into tracts or nuclei. And nuclei is just cell bodies. A tract is the axons from those cell bodies. All right, but the nucleus of an atom is just the very center space right here. And there's two kinds of particles that we can put into a nucleus. We can put protons and we can also put neutrons. Protons have this light blue color. Neutrons have this dark blue color. How did I do? Perfect. Those are blue. Light blue, dark blue. Yeah, good enough. Okay. Okay, so those two particles can exist in the nucleus. A neutron, by its name, has no electrical charge on it. That's what we mean by a neutron. It has a pretty heavy particle, but it has no charge. A proton, on the other hand, has a charge. It's about as heavy as a neutron, but it has an electrical charge. Does anybody know what kind of electrical charge a proton has? It's easy to remember because here's a P right here, and it's a positive charge. But it's a positive electrical charge. So immediately you might start thinking, well, gee whiz, there's electrical charges in my body. And indeed, we are very electrical beings, and we're going to see how that happens. Okay, so there are protons and neutrons inside the nucleus. This nucleus for hydrogen has how many protons that I see right here? It has one proton. How many neutrons? It has none, none whatsoever. Here's another element that we call carbon, and we're going to see that it has six protons, and it also, there are different forms of carbon, but this one right here, this is one that's more the most common kind. It has six neutrons as well, and they're in the nucleus. Okay, so one thing I want to talk about electrical charge before we start to look at this is, what can you tell me, just take a guess, you've probably heard this in your everyday life, but you haven't related this to chemistry. What about opposite charges? Do they attract each other or do they repel each other? Opposite charges. They attract each other, right? Maybe you've talked about that in personalities, personality traits, right? So same charges repel each other, opposite charges attract each other. So if we're going to put a bunch of positive charges inside the nucleus, only positive charges, they're all going to repel each other, and some of those positive charges will want to break away from the nucleus, and that is usually a really high energy incident, and that's damaging, very damaging to biological tissue. It also means that that atom is not stable. So to get all those positive charges together in a small space so that they don't fly apart, okay, in our world, there has to be neutrons that kind of separate them, that allow all those positive charges to exist within the nucleus. That's why they are there. What's most important for you to understand is that the number of protons in the nucleus determines what kind of element it is. If the number of protons changes, then that atom changes whatever element it is. It changes from hydrogen to calcium or iron, right, or helium. And we're going to give you a chart to figure that out. All right, so neutrons and protons are in the nucleus. And then the other domain, okay, in the solar system model, they're going to be orbits of things. What kind of things are going to be in these orbits around the nucleus? It's the last particle, and those are electrons, right? And it just so happens that those electrons have a negative charge, and it's exactly opposite the charge on a proton. The mass of an electron is really radically different compared to the mass of a proton and a neutron, but that's not important in this class, right? The only thing you have to realize is that the magnitude of the charge on a proton and of this little tiny electron here are exactly the same, but opposite. And what can we say about opposite things, opposite electrical charge? They attract each other, right? Okay, so these electrons have a lot of energy. They would like to fly off, but they're attracted to the positive charges inside the nucleus. So they don't break away usually. They just stay in these orbitals. All right, here's a hydrogen atom that has one proton. And to be neutral, then how many electrons will we have in orbitals around the nucleus? We'll have one electron right here. Okay, and then if there's one positive charge, one negative charge, the overall charge is going to be zero of this particular atom. Carbon, okay, we said has six, and this is going to illustrate an important rule, and we'll see how this is also shown for you. You don't have to memorize it, but it's shown on a table really nicely for you to understand. All right, so if we have six protons in the nucleus, which means by definition that's a carbon atom, it's going to have how many electrons in orbitals? It's going to have six as well, right? And then when that's the case, then the overall charge is going to be six positives, six negatives, which is absolutely zero. It's not going to have any kind of charge on it whatsoever. All right, but there's a certain rule on how these electrons fill up orbitals around atoms. The innermost orbital right here, okay, can only have two electrons in it. That's it. That's the maximum number. But we have six altogether. So this first orbital gets two, and then the remaining four electrons have to go in an orbital that is farther out from this first one. So here's the second orbital. And we place four electrons in the outermost orbital. All right, and then we got six electrons, six protons. We have a neutral atom right here. Okay, so jot this down. The inner orbital has got space for two electrons. The outer orbital has space for actually eight electrons, not just four. But there's room for eight, but I only see four in this particular area right over here. All right, so we're going to talk about that in just a second. So maybe you have to be a little bit familiar with atomic mass and atomic number. Most important for you to understand is atomic number. Atomic number is just the number of protons inside the nucleus because it determines what kind of element it is, whether it's a hydrogen or helium or sodium or sulfur or any of those different kinds of elements. But to make nuclei, the nucleus of atoms, stable, sometimes we have to add neutrons to it. And physicists have come up with another term called the atomic mass. And the atomic mass is just the sum of all the things that have mass inside the nucleus, which include neutrons as well as protons. Okay. All right, so we're going to be interested in atomic number mostly. Maybe just a little bit I'll talk about atomic mass. All right, so neutrons and protons are found in the nucleus. Electrons are found in orbitals. Another name for an orbital is a shell. Right, that is outside the nucleus, and they're formed in layers. And in this class, we're just going to think of these as nice circular orbitals. Right, the number of shells depends on the number, on the atomic number, because the first shell can only contain two electrons, and the second shell contain up to eight electrons. Right, and so totally then, if the first and second shells completely filled up, then you would have 10 electrons, and you'd have 10 protons inside the nucleus. And we're going to see, I could ask you that in just a second, what's the name of the element that has 10 protons inside the nucleus? It's just by definition. We're going to find out where you can find that definition, and I'll provide that chart to you on a test. All right, you just have to know how to use it a little bit. All right, electrons in distant shells have a higher energy. I don't think we're really too interested in that. One thing I do want you to know is that the electrons in the outermost shell, whether an atom has one or two or three shells, whichever one is the farther filled up that has electrons, it's farthest away from the nucleus, those are what we call valence electrons. The outermost shell is the valence shell. And that's important because those are the electrons in that valence shell, or the one that's farthest away from the nucleus, those are the ones that can participate and make chemical bonds. And so we want to see how different atoms can come together or split apart via these chemical bonds. So we're going to look at those valence electrons. We're going to be really interested. Ah, here we have it right here. Yeah, valence electrons are those that are in the outermost shell. These are what form and break chemical bonds. And so this is how atoms join together or break apart, or how molecules join together or break apart. And a molecule is just a particle that has more than one atom associated with it. That's what we mean by a molecule. An atom, really, we don't consider that a molecule because there's only one particular particle right there. All right, this is where neutrons play a little bit of a role. We said neutrons are inside the nucleus because it keeps all those protons in that small space, but so that they don't repel each other so much that a proton likes to fly out of the nucleus. All right, so we see that an atom like carbon, for instance, can exist in a state where there are different numbers of neutrons inside the nucleus. All right, but it's always going to be the same number of protons. But there might be a circumstance where there's a different number of neutrons, and if you have an atom or atoms with different numbers of neutrons inside the nucleus, those are going to be isotopes of each other. They're going to be the same element, but we call those isotopes. And some isotopes are stable and some isotopes are very unstable. It all depends on the number of neutrons that are inside the nucleus. All right, so an isotope is an element. They're all the same element, but they're different because they contain a different number of neutrons. And since these particles can pass through people's bodies, and sometimes we can detect them, then they're really good for, and they're also high energy, they could be good for destroying tissue that's in your body. What kind of tissue would you not want to have that you want to destroy, that you might want to have an isotope shoot protons through? Like if you have a tumor someplace, right, and it can't be removed surgically very well, well, we can focus protons on that tissue, and since it's a high-energy beam of protons, it will destroy that tumor. That's really, really nice. It's just not as precise as a scalpel going in and removing a tumor. There's some gray areas. So recurrence of cancer, okay, is not quite so good. But if it's in a part of the body that you can't get to with a scalpel, then really that's kind of your only choice. Yeah, question. Different number of neutrons. That's right. So same number of protons, so it's the same element, but a different number of neutrons that makes it an isotope. And some isotopes are more stable than others. Okay, some isotopes, carbon 12 is very stable. Carbon 13 has one more neutron. It is stable as well, even though it is an isotope. Okay. All right, so here is a table that's not in your book. All right, but it's in your slides right here, and I do want you to know something about this table. You do have to memorize some things. On this table, we have a bunch of words right here, and these are important atoms that we have in our body. These are important atoms that make up our body. And there's many more kinds of elements out there. Those are not so important for us, but all of these are. Some in high concentrations and some in extremely low amounts. But even if you don't have that extremely low amount, okay, you'll enter into a disease state. So I do want you to know oxygen and carbon and hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, how to spell them out. But typically, we don't really write the whole word out for these elements. We use an abbreviation, especially when we start to write out chemical reactions. And the abbreviation, the chemical symbol for oxygen is O. That's really nice. The chemical symbol for carbon is C. The chemical symbol for hydrogen is H. And you're going to say, well, what do I have to memorize here? That's just really too simple. Well, sometimes it is really not so simple. For instance, here is an element called potassium, and the chemical symbol is K. It's not P, because P stands for phosphorus. That's going to be really nice and easy. And the reason why potassium has the letter K right here, because it was named from the Greek alphabet, and potassium in Greek is called kalium. You don't have to know that, but there is a rhyme and reason to why these things are named the way they are. All right, so S for sulfur, capital C, little L for chlorine. That's really good. A good thing they don't call it capital C by itself, because what does that correspond to? That's just carbon, and then our language would get all mixed up. Right? Magnesium, kind of the same thing, capital M, little G, and sodium is another one of those funny things. It's a capital N and a lowercase a. Sodium is Na, because in Greek it's called natrium. And we're going to see that word natrium used in some hormones are named after that old Greek terminology for sodium. And the same thing for iodine and iron. I is for iodine, and iron has Fe. That stands for ferrium. So these things come from someplace. All right, so I do want you to know column number one and column number two over here. All right, so if somebody writes down on a piece of paper Mg, I do want you to know that's magnesium and where to find this on some other tables. This third column over here, I just didn't delete in Photoshop. It's interesting to look at, but you don't have to memorize this one. Only the first two columns. And this is not in your book, so but don't forget to memorize it. Okay. So let me go to, I think I have to bail out of, no, maybe I have it over here. Let's see if I can do this. I'm going to do one and two, and then I'm going to do two and one, and it's going to flip over. Did it flip over? Not at, oh, it did flip over before. Ah, that's where we are. Okay. This right here is the periodic table. And there's a link to this table that's in Blackboard. I'm going to pass this out. This is what's used in the chemistry department. It's kind of mislabeled in the chemistry department. It's called atomic masses, but really this is what we call the periodic table because there are some patterns in here that repeat over and over and over again. All right, so we talked about knowing some chemicals by their chemical symbol. Not all of these you have to know, but the ones that are important inside our bodies. And what about H? Was that important to know? It was, and that's hydrogen, right? And we see that right over here. And there's a number one. Do you see this number one right there? That means that there's one proton in the nucleus. So anytime you run into an atom with one proton in the nucleus, what does it have to be? Can't be anything else. It's got to be hydrogen or H, right? And then if we move over to the right over here, we're going to see another atom. And how many protons are in the nucleus of this one? Two. It's not on your list, but from this table you can tell that there are two protons in this nucleus, and this is helium. Maybe at parties you would use this thing, but that's about it. Okay? You wouldn't use this biologically for anything. It has two protons inside the nucleus, which makes it different than hydrogen. All right, what about this thing Li? Li, you don't have to know, used pharmacologically sometimes. We call this lithium. And how many protons are in the nucleus for lithium? Three. Okay, and on and on and on and on. And here it says, for C, what element is C?
Carbon.
It's carbon. Carbon has six protons. So you're going to have this table on the test. You don't have to memorize how many protons are in the nucleus. But I might ask you, for instance, for calcium, and I see calcium over here, and I'll ask you how many protons are in the nucleus for calcium. And you look and look and look, and you see calcium right here because you know the chemical symbol for calcium is Ca. And here's a table, it's just glaring at you. It says 20 protons in the nucleus, okay, which is what we call the atomic number. So that's really handy. The other thing about this table right here is that it has a really nice arrangement, okay. It also tells us how orbitals or shells are filled up. And we just mentioned that the first orbital has how many electrons? How many electrons can go into the first orbital? Two. And when we look at the periodic table, it tells us that too. So you don't have to memorize that. If we look at the first row, how many elements do we have in the first row? There are two. That means that there can be two electrons in that first orbital or that first shell. The second shell can have how many electrons? Let's look down here to the second row. How many elements do we have in this second row? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So there can be 8 electrons in that second orbital. What about the third orbital? Exactly the same, 8. Okay, and then things get a little bit more interesting down over here, but we're not going to talk about those orbitals, other kinds of p orbitals and things like that, but they're actually pretty important in biology if you get to that level, because there can be some interesting associations between elements in our body based on some of these valence electrons or orbitals later on. Okay, but it's not so important for the physiology that we're looking at. But these others right here, these first three rows, that will be important. But you do have to know some compounds that are not contained within the first three rows. For instance, like what? Potassium, calcium, pretty important. You think calcium is important in our body? Do you think calcium is important in our body? Okay, you have no idea right now how important that is. That's hugely important, okay? Right now, you know how important it is for bones, but it's going to be important for all kinds of things. And then one of the last things you're going to be concerned about of where you have calcium is in your bones. Okay, that's going to be like the last thing on your mind, but that's even important by itself. All right, so I'm going to give you this periodic table. You have to know these different elements by their name according to their chemical symbol, and you also have to know what the atomic number is and then how to use these different rows right here to make chemical bonds, different kinds of chemical bonds. Okay, all right, so that all seems pretty mysterious right at the moment. So let's talk about some of this stuff. Where did we want to go? Here and here. Nope. Here and here. Yes. Okay. So that's good for now. So chemical bonds. We're going to use our orbital theory and our understanding of an atom to think about chemical bonds. All right. So a chemical bond is something that attracts atoms together to form a molecule, right? Because a molecule is a set of atoms that are joined together. A molecule is not just one atom someplace, but it's going to be a couple atoms joined together by chemical bonds. And those chemical bonds are going to be due to some kind of something happening with these valence electrons. And again, where are those valence electrons always located? The outermost shell. Yeah, the outermost shell. Okay, and the number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. So for the first orbital, how many electrons fit in that first orbital?
Two.
Okay, and so what we mean here by completing the outermost shell, it means that in order for an atom that only has that first orbital, there should be two electrons in the outermost shell for it to be stable. That's its most happy condition. Okay, now what about atoms that have electrons in the second orbital or second shell? How many electrons should be in that shell in order for that element to be stable? There has to be eight, right? So in that particular case, eight is good, but also zero is good, because then that means that the orbital that's innermost to the one that has zero is filled up. Okay, so the valence orbital should be completely filled up or have none at all for it to be stable. Okay, so the first kind, maybe I'll tell you before we get to that kind, the four kinds of chemical bonds that we're going to look at in this class. And I want you to be able to arrange them in order of strength. And the strongest one is a covalent bond. Covalent. What is the strongest one? Don't ever get tricked by any kind of statement. Which is the strongest kind of bond? Covalent is the strongest bond. The next strongest, or a little bit weaker, is called ionic bond. Is the next weaker bond. Some students learn that ionic bonds can be as strong as covalent someplace. I don't know where you learn that, okay? But it won't work in this class, okay? Strongest is covalent. The second strongest is ionic. All right, weaker than that, actually a lot weaker than an ionic bond, is what we call a hydrogen bond. All right, and even weaker than that is called a van der Waals, capital V-A-N, and then a new word, lowercase D-E-R, and then the third word starts with a capital W-W-A-A-L-S. I'll have some slides of these things, but that just gives you a little foreshadowing that we're going to talk about those four kinds. Okay, so let me just say it again. The strongest is covalent, the next is ionic, the next strongest is hydrogen, and then the weakest is a van der Waals force. A lot of people don't even consider it a bond, but for us, a bond is anything that will join molecules or atoms together, somehow attract them so that they join together. Okay, covalent bonds occurs when atoms share valence electrons. So that's the key term for covalent bond. You're going to think of sharing of electrons. So you have two nuclei someplace, and they're going to share electrons. One nucleus is not going to grab it away from the other. These electrons are going to be shared. So here we have a atom with just one proton in the nucleus. And if I was showing you the periodic table, you could tell me what element that is, but maybe you already know because we talked about it a little bit. What atom is this that has one proton in the nucleus? That's a hydrogen, right? And how many electrons then does a hydrogen have in all of the orbitals that it has? Right, it only has one orbital and it has one electron. But remember, we said that atoms are most stable when the shell is completely filled up with electrons. So since there's only one electron in the shell, that hydrogen atom is going to look around all over the universe for another electron someplace to fill up that shell. And it's going to bump into, eventually, another hydrogen atom, right, because here's one proton. And that one that hydrogen with one proton has one electron in its valence shell. So these guys go into negotiation and they say, well, you know what? We'll fill up your outermost shell, okay, if you will share your electron with me. And the other atom says, okay, well, I'll do that if you share your electron with me. And so these two atoms will share these two electrons, and then they'll both sort of feel like their valence electron is filled up. Their valence shell is filled up with electrons to the maximum, which in this particular case is two. So this now, is this an atom? We would want to call this a molecule because there's two atoms right here. So this molecule has one chemical bond between them because there is one pair of electrons, and that makes one covalent bond. All right, and in this particular case, this nucleus, what's the difference between this nucleus up over here and this nucleus down over here? Same color, blue, right? Both circular, and they both have one proton. So there's no difference between them, right? So these two electrons really don't care if they're around the top nucleus or the bottom nucleus. It really doesn't matter to them. And they're going to spend time in equal amounts above and below this line right here. If that's the case, we're going to call that a nonpolar covalent bond. Nonpolar means that these electrons can be found with just as much probability anywhere between these two atoms, right? They just wander around very quickly. These are nonpolar covalent bonds. And is that a strong bond or a weak bond?
Strong.
That's strong. That's a strong bond, which means that there is a lot of energy associated with this bond when it's put together or when it's broken. When it's put together, it takes energy. When it's broken, it releases energy and releases a lot. Okay, so to break this bond, what kind of energy you need? A lot, because we said that was a strong bond. Okay. Nonpolar. Well, we're going to look at another molecule called H2O. And you probably have known a lot about H2O already. You probably know what it is before taking this class. What's H2O? Water. Yeah, it's got to be my favorite molecule. Probably not yours yet, but it's close to being your favorite molecule. So let's build this molecule up. All right, so you might need, I don't have a periodic table to show. I can throw that on there. Let's throw a periodic table on there. I don't need this diagram, hopefully, to draw this out. Is it there? It's there. Okay, so we got H2O. So here we're using some chemical symbols. O stands for oxygen, H stands for hydrogen, and this little nomenclature 2 right here means how many hydrogens are there on this molecule? There are two. That's what that means. Okay. All right, so let's start with oxygen. Inside the nucleus, how many protons do we have inside the nucleus for an oxygen? How on earth are you going to find that? I mean, I don't even know. How would I go about finding that? I would Google periodic table, look at the periodic table, and it's going to show me right there. Okay? So I'll take your advice without even checking on you because it's so easy. All right, how many protons are in the nucleus for oxygen?
Eight.
All right, so we got eight right here. Eight protons, that's how I'll label it right here. So we have some orbitals with electrons, right? And let me just use a different color for fun. Let's see if I can make sense out of that. Here's the first orbital right here. It's going to have electrons in it, right? Neutrons and protons are in this nucleus right here. So how many electrons in this orbital?
Two.
There's going to be maybe one here and one here, or one here and one here. There's going to be two. So we got a lot of leftover electrons. Let's put them in this orbital right here. And how many do we get to put in there? Okay, we would like to put eight, but we only got six, right? So that's a nice thing to realize. So we got six, but we want eight. So let's put one, two, three, four, five, six. All right, and if we add up all these electrons, how many do we have now? We got eight. Eight electrons and eight protons, so this oxygen is nice and stable, but it's not quite stable because it's looking for an electron to go here and an electron to go here. Who do you know likes to share electrons already? One electron. Hydrogen, yeah, from that previous diagram. So this oxygen right here can bump into a hydrogen. So here's hydrogen. How many protons in the nucleus? One. Oops. One. Okay, and it's going to have one orbital with one electron right here. And so now this is kind of forming really nicely. It still has no electrical charge on it whatsoever. Here is one pair of electrons that's being shared. What kind of bond is that? Sharing of electrons. Covalent, right? That's the key term for covalent. But this oxygen still likes to have one more electron from someplace. Well, it can get one from another hydrogen if it bumps into it, right? So here is an electron from another hydrogen that has one proton inside the nucleus. And now this first valence shell for this hydrogen is completely filled up. That's nice. The valence shell for this hydrogen is completely filled up. You only need two. And the valence shell for oxygen, is that right? Could you tell this is oxygen with eight protons in there? Yeah. The outermost shell for oxygen is now filled up. Okay, so water is a pretty stable molecule because everybody has their valence shells filled up. But before this happened, right, there were deficiencies in these valence shells which have now been satisfied. All right, it just so happens that the nucleus for oxygen is really greedy, much more greedy than the nucleus for these hydrogens right here. So when it forms a covalent bond like this, sharing of electrons, these electrons that it gets from hydrogens get pulled into the nucleus more. Okay, so you have to kind of go beyond the solar system model for chemical bonds just a little bit. So this one electron from hydrogen spends more time over by this oxygen than it does over here. That forms a polar covalent bond because this electron gets sucked up into the nucleus right here because this nucleus, we say, it has more electronegativity. Same thing for this electron. These two over here don't spend as much time over here. They spend more time closer to the oxygen nucleus. That's just the way it goes because of the nature of this nucleus right here. All right, so if we look at all of the protons and all of the electrons, how many are there? How many protons are there on this molecule? We got 8, 9, 10. 10 protons. How many electrons? 8, 9, 10. So overall, what's the electrical charge on this water molecule? Because the charge of a proton and electron are exactly opposite each other, so they completely cancel out. So the overall charge of this thing is zero, but because these electrons like to be over here, something fantastic happens, which makes this going to be your favorite molecule. Okay, we said electrons have what kind of charge? Positive or negative? Negative. So if we put more negative charge over here, this end of the molecule, okay, when you start to get close to it, okay, is going to have a little bit of a negative charge. Okay, how do we symbolize that? I forget what the symbol is. A little bit of a negative charge. Even though when you look at this molecule from far away, it looks neutral. Okay, but if you look at it from this end, it's going to look negative. And if you walk up on this molecule from this end, what does it look like? It's going to look a little positive. And if you walk up from this end, it's going to look a little positive, right? Like that. So this is a polar molecule because on one end it's a little bit negative, on the other end it's a little bit positive. These two positives right here cancel out this one right there. But nonetheless, we say it's polar because one end is negative and the other is positive. And this end right here, what is it going to want to attract? A positive charge, a negative charge, or no charge whatsoever? Yeah, opposite charges attract. So this water molecule is going to attract at this end something that looks negative, and this end of the water molecule is going to attract something that looks positive. Okay, so that's really the fascinating thing about this molecule. So let's kind of look at this now in terms of the notes that you have. Is that what I have to do? I do. Okay, so that's what this diagram shows. You see, this is a water molecule, and you can build that now according to your orbital theory if you had a periodic table someplace. Maybe it's too hard to see. How about like something like that? Okay, so here's that oxygen, and you can see one end is a little bit negative, the other end is a little bit positive. So now if we put two of these molecules together in a space, two water molecules, I tell you what, let's put this hydrogen back up over here. These water molecules will attract each other. And how will they attract each other? this positive region of a water molecule is going to be attracted to this negative region. So this hydrogen will kind of be attracted to this this oxygen over here, okay, just because of water molecules. All right, but what I really want you to see is this bond between the oxygen and the hydrogen, this bond between this hydrogen and this oxygen. How many electrons are between oxygen and hydrogen here? There's one pair. Same over here, there's one pair. Okay, and that's, so that forms one covalent bond, a strong bond. And what can you tell me about that bond? Is it polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
It's polar because those electrons that are being shared are pulled more into the oxygen. Okay, it is possible under certain circumstances for one hydrogen to bump off, and when it does, we call that dissociation. It can't pull its electron with itself, so we just have a single proton in solution, right? We call that a hydrogen ion. Since it can't go along with its electron, right, it has a positive charge on it. So this right here is what we call a hydrogen ion, and a hydrogen ion is just what, a proton sitting in solution, same thing. We use that terminology similarly. That electron ended up on this molecule over here. That's a hydroxide ion, and it has a negative charge. All right, so these things can combine and dissociate regularly in our bodies. And it all depends on the concentration of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions in our body. Even though these are strong bonds, these things always exist partially in some dissociated form. Okay, so those are covalent bonds. The term to think, the one word to always remember about a covalent bond is, in terms of electrons, sharing. The other thing you should realize is that it's the strongest kind, and there are two kinds of covalent bonds that we're going to be interested in, polar and nonpolar covalent bonds. Okay, but maybe I'll just tell you a little bit. Molecules that have a charge on them, okay, like to be in a system of molecules that are polar, right? Because you have opposite charges attracting each other. Now, a water molecule like this that is polar, you think it's going to like to be in an environment where there are nonpolar molecules because there are no charges right here. That's right. So polar compounds really don't want to have anything to do with nonpolar compounds, and the reverse of that is true as well. These kinds of bonds, okay, nonpolar covalent bonds, we see in things called fats or lipids, right? And polar bonds are what we see in things that can dissolve in water. And you know that, what about oil and water, a lipid and water? Do they mix together? Absolutely not, and this is the reason why, because of the difference in whether they're polar or nonpolar covalent bonds. Okay, the next kind of bond, we call these ionic bonds. And ionic bond is just due to the overall charge on an atom. And that bond is going to be between an atom that has a positive charge and an atom that has a negative charge. And those two atoms then will be attracted to each other. Okay, I took the periodic table away. But we're going to be working with something here called sodium. How many protons are in the nucleus for sodium? Rats. What do I have to do to get back to that periodic table? Can I just do that? Yeah, I can. Okay, so what's the symbol for sodium? Na. And if you look at sodium up over here, you see it has 11 electrons, or 11 protons inside the nucleus, which means it has 11 electrons, which is kind of an odd number of electrons. That's not going to fill up orbitals completely, because to fill up them, you have to have, what, 10? Okay, or what, 18? That's kind of a weird number. And then we have another atom here called chlorine. How many protons does chlorine have?
17.
Okay, do you see it right here? Ah, 17, Cl, chlorine, 17. Another kind of weird number. All right, so let's put these two atoms together and see what happens. Okay, I'm not concerned about the neutrons. Here we have a sodium with 12 neutrons in there. We don't care. Ah, you didn't see it. How do we get for you to see that? We do that? Thank you for telling me. Okay. 2-1. What happens if I do this? No. But if I do that, yes. Okay, that helps me because I see both monitors the same. Okay, so here we have a sodium, and we said 11 protons, so that means it has 11 electrons. Let's fill up its orbitals. The first orbital has 2, right? The next orbital has 8, 2 plus 8 is 10, which means how many are left over? 1. And it's a very lonely electron in this valence shell over here. Very unstable. Sodium would love to get rid of that electron, donate it to somebody. Okay, and fortunately, it can bump into a chlorine atom. And we said chlorine has 17 protons, which means it has 17 electrons. Let's fill up, let's make the shells fill up. 2 with the first one, 8 in the second one, so that's 10. How many are left over? 7, so let's put 7 electrons in the valence shell over here, which means that it is missing how many to become stable? It's missing 1. So chlorine and sodium are perfect matches for each other because sodium wants to donate an electron and chlorine would love to accept that electron. So an ionic bond is due to these valence electrons, but not because they want to share, it's because one wants to donate and the other one wants to accept. Totally different kind of circumstance, right? All right, so that when the sodium gives this electron away, right, it has more protons in the nucleus than it has electrons in these orbitals. So overall, this is going to have what kind of charge, electrical charge? It's going to be a plus 1, okay? And chlorine, on the other hand, right, is going to have an extra electron. So if we add all of these together, it's going to be exactly a minus 1 electrical charge. Right. And so then we diagram that as follows. We have sodium with a plus 1 charge on it. We have chlorine with a minus 1 charge on it. And these things are what we call ions. Right. An ion is some kind of molecule or atom, even better to think of it, that has an electrical charge that develops very easily and naturally because of these valence shells, the way they fill up, because that's determined by the number of protons inside the nucleus. Okay, so these are electrolytes. And if we have an atom with a plus charge here, like sodium, and an atom with, like chlorine, that has a negative charge, what can you tell me about these two atoms? Are they going to attract or repel each other? They're going to attract each other. And that attraction is what we call an ionic bond. So that when we take these two compounds out of water, it's going to form a bond. And when you look, and that's the same thing as table salt, it forms a crystal. Right? And that crystalline structure is just due to the nature of these bonds right here. Okay, but they still exist as a positive charge and a negative charge. And if we take that crystal of sodium chloride, okay, that has formed this ionic bond and put it in water, will it dissociate in water? Will it dissolve in water? That's a better term. Will it dissolve in water or will it just go to some place in the beaker all by itself? What can you tell me about the water molecule? It's really happy with these ions here because one end of the water molecule is negative, right? A little bit negative. It's going to bind with this sodium ion. And the other end of a water molecule, which is a little bit negative, like the oxygen end, is going to want to bind with this the hydrogen end of the water molecule is going to want to associate with this chloride ion because the chloride is negative. So water and sodium chloride mix together very nicely because of these opposite electrical charges. One last thing that I want to talk about before we leave the slide. If you have an ion or an electrolyte with a plus charge, we call that a cation. And if you have an electrolyte with a negative charge, we call that an anion, just by definition. And some electrolytes might have 2 charges, maybe 2 pluses, not a plus and a minus because that would be 0, but 2 pluses or 3 pluses, right? That would still be a cation, but we talk about them differently. We talk about in terms of what these are valence electrons. So a monovalent cation will be a cation with, what does mono mean?
One
positive charge. Okay. A bivalent cation has 2 positive charges. A bivalent anion, ooh, trying to throw you a curveball. A bivalent anion has what kind of charges on it? 2 negative charges. 2 negative charges right here. Okay, so that's how we talk about these. Sodium and chloride usually are monovalent, but some electrolytes like calcium and magnesium are bivalent. So we want to look at those things. Right, so those are ionic bonds. And so we said that when we put sodium chloride, which is a molecule, when it's dry, into water, that ionic bond is so weak that it will dissolve in water. It will break, and that will leave sodium with a positive charge, chlorine with a negative charge, and it will love to associate with the water molecule because the water molecule itself is polar. And it will form these hydration spheres around the sodium and chloride. And how much sodium and chloride can you dissolve in water? A little bit or a lot? A lot, right? Because of these hydration spheres just allows the dissociation or the breaking of that ionic bond. Okay. So ionic bonds are relatively weak. There's enough energy in water, this energy of dissociation right here, just to break that ionic bond apart. So ionic bonds are really weak. Okay. Ionic bonds. Okay, ionic bonds. Some molecules are hydrophilic, some are hydrophobic. What does philic mean? They love. Philic means love. And hydro means water. So some molecules love water. Okay, and we call those hydrophilic. These are molecules that are soluble in water because they can form hydration spheres like sodium and chloride. All right, but there's other kinds of molecules that are hydrophilic, like glucose and some amino acids, because they have covalent bonds that are polar. They have covalent bonds that are polar. Notice we don't have any kind of lipid or fat molecule here. All right, so glucose and amino acids have polar covalent bonds. Other kinds of molecules we say are hydrophobic, means that they hate water, because they have covalent bonds that are nonpolar. They can't form hydration spheres around them. Let me see what the next slide is. Okay. We missed something, but I have to talk about it somewhere. Probably this is a good place. Maybe I'll turn the light on. So what kinds of covalent bonds form polar covalent bonds? So I'm going to write that on the board now. All right, so a covalent bond is an element forming a bond with hydrogen. So hydrogen is always going to be involved. And what element did we see when it bound hydrogen forms a polar covalent bond? The other element that joins with hydrogen right here is a little greedy. It pulls some of the electrons away from hydrogen, even though they're supposed to be shared, but not equally. Oxygen, like in water, right? So that is one element. If you see hydrogen bound to an oxygen, that's going to form a polar covalent bond, and it's going to want to dissolve in water. Okay, another element that does that is phosphorus, right? Phosphorus, when it's bound to hydrogen, forms a polar covalent bond. So chemical compounds that have a phosphorus like to dissolve in water, no problem. Okay. Sulfur is another one. When you have hydrogen bound to a sulfur, that forms a compound that likes to dissolve in water because, what, it forms a polar covalent bond. And then the last atom, when bound to hydrogen, is nitrogen. Okay, so you got to know these chemical symbols. So when you have molecules with these atoms in it, when they're bound to hydrogen, okay, that forms a polar covalent bond, and these compounds like to dissolve in water. An element that forms a nonpolar covalent bond, okay, and it's got to be with what, a hydrogen? We can have a carbon atom. I don't see carbon right here. When it's bound to hydrogen, that's a nonpolar covalent bond. So molecules that are made up with these kinds of bonds can't dissolve in water because these are nonpolar, these are polar, including water right there. Right, that OH is just kind of a building block of water. All right, so this is going to be important that you remember this list right here. There is a slide, but the slide I think is missing this sulfur group. Okay, don't miss that sulfur group right there. Okay, I know what some of you are thinking right now. I sign up for Bio 241. Key word, biology. Okay, and what are we learning? Chemistry right now. But this is true. We got to get this down. We got to get a little bit of chemistry down before we really understand physiology and biology. Okay, because chemistry is fundamental. Yeah. Oh, the sign-in sheet. Yeah, what time do we end class here? 12:45. Okay, it's by alphabetical order. So you should be able to find your name pretty easily. Go ahead and sign your name and pass it around really quick. Okay. Can you see it well enough with the lights off? Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, pass that around. Okay, so we talked about covalent bonds as being very strong, ionic bonds as being not as strong, and what's the next one? A hydrogen bond. Okay, they're really weak. And here I see a water molecule, right, H2O, and then I see another H2O, and you can see that there is a bond between them symbolized by this dotted line, and you know that to be true because this end of the polar water molecule is negative, this end of the polar water molecule is positive, opposite charges attract, so this water molecule will be attracted to this one, and this one will be attracted to this one for the same reason, all the way around. So water molecules, right, are joined together with very weak hydrogen bonds. And as a matter of fact, if you look at water and think about water, okay, as a fluid, it has a lot of crystalline structure to it because these water molecules everywhere are joined together with these weak hydrogen bonds. You could actually think of water as a liquid crystal. It's part like a crystal like sodium chloride, but part like a liquid where the water molecules can separate. And as a matter of fact, you probably realize that these water molecules get stuck together because there are some animals that can walk right on the surface of a lake or a stream or right on the surface of water. They're not heavy enough to push these hydrogen bonds apart and go kaplunk into the water. We are heavy enough, right? If you step on water, kaplunk, you'll go right in. Okay, but there are some animals that are so light they won't do that. Who knows what kind of animal I'm talking about? And they're like water spiders. Many insects can walk right on water because they're too light. Right, the water molecules get stuck together, and that feature of water molecules sticking together is what we call surface tension. Okay, so this is surface tension, and that's going to be important in some parts of our body. In other parts of our body, it has to be defeated. These hydrogen bonds have to be broken, okay, in order for your body to work right. So that's another important physical chemistry concept, the surface tension, right? Sometimes it's very important. We want things to be glued together. At other times, we want these water molecules to separate from each other very rapidly. Okay. How's that sign-in sheet going? Pretty well. Where's it? Okay, good. Keep it going around. Okay, next topics. All right, notice we didn't talk about van der Waals forces, but if you're going to rank van der Waals forces in terms of strength, where would it rank? It's the weakest. Yeah, it's the weakest. Okay, and so here we see a hydrogen bond between opposite charges of polar molecules. Van der Waals forces are due to areas within a molecule that are nonpolar. All right, so nonpolar regions in different molecules like to associate with each other because they don't like to be in water. All right, so hydrophobic compounds associate very weakly like a hydrogen bond because of van der Waals forces. Okay, acids, bases, and the pH scale. This is a little counterintuitive, so we're going to talk about pH a little bit. An acid is any kind of molecule that releases hydrogen ions into a solution. And what's another way that we could talk about a hydrogen ion? It's a cation for sure, because why? What does it have in terms of those subatomic particles? It's only got one proton in the nucleus. It has no electrons, right? It only has one proton. So a hydrogen ion, because it only has one proton, sometimes we call it a proton because that's what it is. So hydrogen ion and proton are really exactly the same thing. Okay, an acid is a compound that releases these protons into a solution. So we consider that a proton donor or a hydrogen ion donor. A base, on the other hand, okay, releases a hydroxide ion or lowers the proton levels into a solution. It's a proton acceptor, like an OH minus group, right? An OH minus group will take a proton right out of water. And if you take a proton, a hydrogen ion, and an OH minus, a hydroxide ion, and you put them together, what do you get? You got two hydrogens and one oxygen. We have H2O, right, which is water. Okay, so that's why acids and bases are something that we're really interested in, because it's based on water chemistry. So pH makes sense when you're talking about water chemistry. It doesn't make much sense if you're talking about it in some other kind of solution, okay, like an oil, for instance, or gasoline. Gasoline really doesn't have a pH because it's not a water system. Here are some common acids. Hydrochloric acid, that's just HCl. And when you put HCl in water, this hydrogen ion dissociates from chloride, and now you have this proton that has a positive charge on it, right, floating around in water. Phosphoric acid has three of these protons. Nitric acid has one right here. These are all really strong acids. Well, the first four are strong acids. That means when you put these in water, they completely dissociate. This hydrogen comes off of the other part of the molecule. Carbonic acid is not quite so strong. Sometimes it will hold on to a proton. Okay, so that's what we call a weak acid. All right, so can you see these are all acids because they release this proton? Now, what about over here? If we look at these symbols right here, do you see a proton by itself? I see another group. I see what? An OH group. And when we put sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide or any of these other hydroxides in water, the sodium will dissociate from this OH group, and sodium you're going to have as an ion, as a plus, as a cation. This OH is going to be a negative. And if that OH group bumps into a hydrogen from an acid over here, they're going to combine together to form water. Okay, so that's why we say that sodium hydroxide is a proton acceptor. Okay, because when it dissociates, we have this negative, this anion right here, which will bind to a proton. Okay, so here's just a nice list of some common acids and pHs. Well, we want to be able to talk about how many protons are in solution, because that changes the reactivity, the chemical properties very drastically. And other things, it changes the shape of molecules. And maybe one thing you learned in anatomy is when you change the shape of something, what else changes? Okay, here we have a hand, right? Five fingers still, that's really good. Certainly wasn't guaranteed that, but I still have them. I have a thumb, right? And what can I do with that thumb? Just because of the structure of my hand, right? Because it's a really funny saddle joint right there. It's an opposable digit, so I can grasp something very nicely, right? Play tennis, right? Do chin-ups, all that kind of stuff. I can write very easily because I have that thumb right there. Now, what were to happen to the function of this hand if we change the structure and remove that thumb? So now I only have these four fingers right here. I can sort of grasp something, but I can't really grasp a tennis racket the same way, or a golf club, or even a pencil or a pen. So we've changed the structure. What happened to the function of this hand? It changed as well. Okay. Same thing for when we change the hydrogen ion concentration in a solution, or the acidity of a solution, we're changing the structure of all the molecules that are in that solution. And we change the structure of all those molecules, then what happens to all those molecules? Their functions change as well, right? And so the structure of molecules is very sensitive to the amount of hydrogen ions that are in solution. So that means that the hydrogen ion concentration can very easily and drastically change the structure of molecules that are in our body, which means it's going to change how they function as a result of that. Okay. So pH is a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration in solution. And it's a number from 1 to 14, and it could be, you can have decimal places here, like you can have 0.1, 0.2. Okay, it doesn't have to be just an integer. And it just so happens that as something becomes more acidic, the number gets smaller. The pH number gets smaller. So we have a scale from 0 to 14. If we were going to pick one of these numbers, right, which is the most acidic number, which one would we pick, 0 or 14? 0. Okay. So as the number of hydrogens in solution increases, the pH number decreases. All right, so I want to use my hands again to show you. So as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, it becomes more acidic. Hydrogen ions increase, more acidic. Well, what about the pH number? Goes the opposite way. That's why this is so counterintuitive, right? So as the pH number decreases, the acidity increases. All right, so here we have an equation that actually shows us that. The pH is just calculated by taking the log to the base 10 of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration in molarity. All right, so we can measure the concentration of hydrogen ions, put it into this equation, and then calculate what the pH is. And you have some homework problems to do that. That could certainly be a problem on a test that's coming up. Okay, so we want to be, so get a calculator and know how to use that log button on it to the base 10. Not the natural log to the base E, but to the base 10. Okay, your lab instructors will be able to show you how to do that. Visit me during office hours. Okay, and I give you some pretty good examples. All right, if I give you the pH, you should be able to calculate the hydrogen ion concentration, go back and forth. Okay, so one last thing. What's the number that's right in the middle of 0 and 14? It is 7. 7 means that there's an equal number of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions. There's not more one than the other. And if you have the same number of positive charges as negative charges, what can you tell me about that? We say that is neutral. So pH 7 is neutral. It's neither acidic nor basic. All right, so let's see. Next week, Tuesday. Yeah, don't forget. Don't come to school Monday, but we don't meet on Monday. We'll see you Tuesday, and we're going to start talking about pH. We'll finish up pH a little bit. You might want to do a homework problem. Try to calculate pH. Okay, sign it. Where's the sign-in sheet at? It's only about halfway done. Okay. So get a pen out for those of you that still need to sign the sign-in sheet and sign your name really fast. Yeah, you're not on that list. Okay, that list that's going around has the names of students that are officially registered in the class. So if that sheet came by you and your name's not on it, then you're not registered for the class, even if you thought you were. So you probably got to see me.